Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Sunday, January 23rd, reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Ukraine, Russia toughens its posture amid tensions, by Vladimir Izichenkov. Britain, Russia seeks own leader for Ukraine, by Jill Lawless and Jari Tanner. Cost of living concerns. Democrats look to trim fees. Coloradans will get biggest check from Tabor, but it also limits what lawmakers can do, by Alex Burness. COVID-19 treatments. Some could be difficult to find. Antiviral and antibody options depend on your health risk and if you take other medications, by Meg Wingerter. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Ukraine. Russia toughens its posture amid tensions, by Vladimir Izichenkov, the Associated Press, byline, Moscow. With tens of thousands of Russian troops positioned near Ukraine, the Kremlin has kept the U.S. and its allies guessing about its next moves in the worst security crisis to emerge between Moscow and the West since the Cold War. Amid fears of an imminent attack on Ukraine, Russia has further upped the ante by announcing more military drills in the region. It also has refused to rule out the possibility of military deployments to the Caribbean, and President Vladimir Putin has reached out to leaders opposed to the West. The military muscle flexing reflects a bold attempt by the Kremlin to halt decades of NATO expansion after the end of the Cold War. In talks with the United States, Russia demands legally binding guarantees that the alliance will not embrace Ukraine or other former Soviet nations or place weapons there. It also wants NATO to pull back its forces from countries in Central and Eastern Europe that have joined the alliance since the 1990s. Putin has described NATO membership for Ukraine and the others, as well as alliance's weapons deployments there, as a red line for Moscow, warning that he would order unspecified military technical measures if the demands aren't met. Putin pointed to NATO drills with the Ukrainian military, increasing frequent visits of the alliance warships in the Black Sea, and the flights of U.S. bombers near Crimea to emphasize the urgency of Russia's security demands. He argued that by creating training centers in Ukraine, Western powers can establish a military foothold there even without its joining NATO. "We have nowhere to retreat," Putin said. "They have taken it to the point where we simply must tell them stop." Russia, which annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in 2014, has denied it intends to attack its neighbor. Last year, however, Putin issued a stark warning that an attempt by Ukraine to reclaim control of the areas in the east controlled by Russia-backed separatists would have grave consequences for Ukrainian statehood. While Ukrainian authorities denied planning such offensive, U.S. intelligence officials concluded that already Russia had deployed operatives to carry out acts of sabotage in the rebel east and blamed them on Russia in a false flag operation to create a pretext for possible invasion. Russia has rejected the claim as total disinformation. Putin repeatedly has asserted that Russians and Ukrainians are one people, and says large portions of Ukrainian territory are historic parts of Russia, arbitrarily granted to Ukraine by communist leaders during Soviet times. More than 14,000 people have been killed in nearly 8 years of fighting in Ukraine's industrial heartland, called the Donbas, where the Moscow-supported insurgency erupted shortly after the annexation of Crimea. A 2015 peace deal brokered by France and Germany helped end large-scale battles, but a political settlement has stalled, and frequent skirmishes have continued along the tense line of contact. Early last year, a spike in ceasefire violations in the east and a Russian troop concentration near Ukraine ignited the invasion fears, but tensions abated when Moscow pulled back the bulk of its forces after maneuvers in April. The military buildup near Ukraine resumed in the fall, with Ukrainian and Western officials warning that the increasing troop concentration could herald a multi-pronged Russian attack. Putin noted with satisfaction that Russia has caused a certain stress in the West. "It's necessary to keep them in that condition for as long as possible," he said in November, ordering his diplomats to push for binding guarantees against NATO expansion. While the U.S. and its allies rejected the Russian demands for a halt to NATO expansion, some observers note that Moscow's insistence on a written reply may reflect an intention to use it as an argument for a possible escalation. At this stage, the parties don't intend to compromise and want to shift responsibility for a potential conflict, said Kirill Rogov, a Moscow-based independent analyst. Adding to an estimated 100,000 troops deployed near Ukraine, Russia also has moved more troops from Siberia and the Far East for joint drills with its ally Belarus, which also borders Ukraine. In those exercises, Russian military units have moved to areas near Belarus's southern border, which is about 47 miles from Kiev. Last week, the Russian Defense Ministry also announced a series of naval maneuvers in the Black Sea and more distant areas such as the Mediterranean, northeastern Atlantic, and the Pacific. The exercises that will start this month and last through February would involve more than 140 ships, dozens of aircraft, and more than 10,000 personnel. Britain. Russia seeks own leader for Ukraine by Jill Lawless and Jari Tanner, the Associated Press, Byline, London. The British government on Saturday accused Russia of seeking to replace Ukraine's government with a pro-Moscow administration and said former Ukrainian lawmaker Yevheny Miryev is being considered as a potential candidate. Miryev is the head of the small pro-Russian party Nashi, which has no seats in Ukraine's parliament. Britain's Foreign Office named several other Ukrainian politicians it said had links with Russian intelligence services. It's unclear what means Britain believes Russia might use to install a friendly government in Kiev. The UK government made the claim based on an intelligence assessment, without providing evidence. It comes amid a war of words between Moscow and the West over Russia's designs on Ukraine. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said the information shines a light on the extent of Russian activity designed to subvert Ukraine and is an insight into Kremlin thinking. Truss urged Russia to de-escalate, end its campaigns of aggression and disinformation, and pursue a path of diplomacy, and reiterated Britain's view that any Russian military incursion into Ukraine would be a massive strategic mistake with severe costs. Britain has sent anti-tank weapons to Ukraine as part of efforts to bolster its defenses against a potential Russian attack. Amid diplomatic efforts to defuse the crisis, U.S. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace is expected to meet Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu for talks in Moscow. No timing has been given for the meeting, which would be the first UK-Russia bilateral defense talks since 2013. The U.S. has mounted an aggressive campaign in recent months to unify its European allies against a new Russian invasion of Ukraine. The White House called the UK government assessment deeply concerning and said it stands with the duly elected Ukrainian government. "This kind of plotting is deeply concerning," said National Security Council spokeswoman Emily Horn. The Ukrainian people have the sovereign right to determine their own future, and we stand with our democratically elected partners in Ukraine. The assessment came as President Joe Biden spent Saturday at the presidential retreat Camp David outside of Washington, huddling with his senior national security team about the Ukraine situation. A White House official said the discussions included efforts to de-escalate the situation with diplomacy and deterrence measures being coordinated closely with allies and partners, including security assistance to Ukraine. Moscow has massed tens of thousands of troops near the Russia-Ukraine border, leading to fears of an invasion. The West has rejected Moscow's main demands, promises from NATO that Ukraine would never be added as a member, that no alliance weapons will be deployed near Russian borders, and that it will pull back its forces from Central and Eastern Europe. A meeting Friday between Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov ended with no breakthrough. Also Saturday, the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry summoned the German ambassador to object to recently circulated video in which the head of the German Navy said that Ukraine would not regain the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia annexed in 2014, and that Russian President Vladimir Putin deserved respect. The comments by Vice Admiral K. Ansham Schonbach sparked consternation and a swift rebuke back in Berlin. By late Saturday, the German Navy chief had tendered his resignation, saying he wanted to prevent further damage resulting from his ill-considered statements in India. Baltic nations to ship arms to Ukraine. The Baltic nations of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania plan to send U.S.-made anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine, a move that the United States fully endorsed Saturday amid Kiev's escalating tensions with Russia. The defense ministers of the three Baltic states said they stand united in our commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity in the face of continued Russian aggression. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saluted the three NATO nations and former Soviet republics for their longstanding support to Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov last week described the West supplying arms to Ukraine as extremely dangerous and said the shipments do nothing to reduce tensions. The defense ministers of the Baltic states said Estonia would provide Javelin anti-tank weapons, and Latvia and Lithuania were sending Stinger anti-aircraft missiles and other related equipment to bolster Kiev's defensive military capabilities. This was from the Associated Press. Cost of living concerns. Democrats look to trim fees. Coloradans will get biggest check from Tabor, but it also limits what lawmakers can do. By Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Governor Jared Polis is pitching increased savings for Coloradans, more than any other campaign pledge by far, as he seeks a second term as governor. People may have picked that up in one of the dozens of references to cost savings in his State of the State speech this month, or on his social media, or when he spoke on the Capitol steps before the 2022 legislative session and promised to work on making the state more affordable for everyone, or in virtually any other recent public remarks not specifically devoted to the pandemic or the Marshall Fire. But, as Polis acknowledges, there are limits to how much money state government can really save people. Colorado's government, unlike Congress, cannot deficit spend, meaning that each year's budget must be balanced against actual revenues. On top of that, there's the fact that Polis and his fellow Democrats who control the legislature and write the budget have some potentially significant disagreements over how to save people money this year, using what levers Colorado has. That all means Coloradans should temper their expectations against reality. Take, for example, the governor's fee relief package, which he has touted early and often in 2022. Included in that package is the delayed implementation of a scheduled 2 cents per gallon fee at gas pumps, waiving of professional licensing fees for nurses and other healthcare workers, waiving of the fee the state typically imposes on people incorporating new businesses, and lowering or freezing fees at the Department of Motor Vehicles. We must double down on our promise to help every business and family succeed, Pola said in his State of the State speech. That means taking less of your hard-earned money in fees and taxes and putting more in your pockets and paychecks. But the fee relief package totals just above $100 million. Were the benefits distributed evenly among Coloradans, each person would be getting $17. Polis is devoting much airspace to line items that promise small amounts of money in most people's pockets. The driver's license fee freeze will save people $1.54, and the vehicle registration fee cut will save people about $11, according to the governor's proposal. People starting new businesses will get $49 in relief. The most substantial savings would go to a subset of folks, healthcare workers, who will each keep up to $162, said State Senator Dominic Moreno, vice chairman of the powerful Joint Budget Committee. I do think it's a response to the reality that a lot of people right now are concerned about how much costs are increasing. They're concerned about inflation, that less and less of their paycheck is take-home pay. It's an effort to respond to that. But, the Commerce City Democrat added, the reality is that many of the proposals are relatively small scale in the grand scheme of things. The car registration fees, it really works out to be saving people maybe a dollar a month. It's not very targeted, and in my view, it doesn't qualify as all that meaningful. Impact of Tabor. To the extent that Coloradans will see significant economic relief from the government this year, most has little or nothing to do with Polis. The Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, Tabor, requires the government to give refunds to citizens in strong fiscal years, such as this one, which means Coloradans are set to receive several hundred dollars on average this year, or more, if they have a high salary. Tabor rules also trigger a temporary income tax cut this year, which will deliver the average person more money than they will get from the entire fee relief package. In an interview with The Post, Pola said that even though he highlights coming tax and fee cuts so regularly, he understands they are just a small part of the picture. He points to much more sweeping efforts his administration has made that will save participating citizens thousands each, universal kindergarten and pre-K, plus recently bolstered tax credits for working families, chief among them. Saving people money, he said, is not something new to us. In November alone, an estimated $261 million flowed into Colorado from the federal expanded child tax credit, which gave hundreds of thousands of Colorado households more than $400 a month on average. That program is dead for now, as Democrats in Congress have failed to pass President Joe Biden's Build Back Better agenda. And it's that kind of money that Polis knows makes a much bigger dent in anything coming out of his office or the legislature. I'm deeply concerned, he said about the child tax credit. A low-income family this past year with kids likely got around $7,200. The state credit is just $1,200 and only goes up to age six. And that was expensive for the state. We never have the ability to do what the federal government is doing, added Alec Garnett, a Denver Democrat and Speaker of the Colorado House. We understand how hard these last couple of years have been on Coloradans. We're trying to do the best we can to let folks know we're working not to solve every problem that they have, but to show people we're on their side. Even if it's a little bit, at least it's something. Little wiggle room. Given that Colorado has such little relative budget flexibility, the people who control the Joint Budget Committee, Democrats have a majority there, as they do throughout the Capitol, feel it's important that the state consider reforms to provide more money to those who need it in a more precise way than, say, across-the-board refunds. Tabor doesn't leave much wiggle room, but it does allow the legislature to decide to a large extent how, although not if, refunds go out in years like this. Look, $100 million is $100 million, said State Senator Chris Hansen, a budget writer and Denver Democrat. What I'd say is that the proposal kicks off a conversation with the legislature about fee relief more broadly, and we are looking at additional options that would likely go further than the initial proposal. It's a pretty long list. I appreciate the governor highlighting this issue, and we've got other additional targeted proposals that we think can make a material difference, particularly to the people who need it most. That may be where Polis splits from his fellow Democrats at the Capitol. He's been a proponent of across-the-board measures, such as cutting or even eliminating the state income tax. And he's been a cheerleader for Tabor refunds, which every income tax filer receives. Progressives such as Hansen and Moreno would, generally speaking, like to see more of the savings go to the neediest interests. Polis hasn't said much about whether he will fight Democrats if and when they try to change the refund scheme. If that's what they want to talk about, we're always open to that, he said. It's not part of our legislative agenda this session. It's a big conversation whether or not Polis wants to have it now. In each of the coming three fiscal years, Colorado is projected to have more than $2 billion to refund. Massive sums in the context of a state budget that lately has hovered around $35 billion, and that this year should reach a record $40 billion. This is very much on the minds of lawmakers who, ironically, could use fee relief in their fight to reform refund mechanisms. That's because when the state takes in fewer fees, it collects less revenue, and there is less overall money left over to be used for refunds. As State Senator Bob Rankin, a budget writer and Carbondale Republican, said, where does fee relief come from? You get less Tabor refund by paying a little less for fees. It's just a shell game. Rankin and other Republicans have taken note of how much Polis has talked about fee and tax cuts lately. Rankin's majority leader, Douglas County Republican State Senator Chris Hulbert, told reporters recently that Polis must be seeing the same polls he's seeing. That would make sense, said the Democratic Colorado pollster Andrew Bauman. The biggest danger for any political party that's in power is to be seen by voters as focusing on the things that aren't important, he said. Right now, they think cost of living is really important. I think it makes all the sense in the world for Democrats to be really single-mindedly focused on that, noting that they have a lot of popular accomplishments from last year's session they can turn back to in the fall. COVID-19 treatments. Some could be difficult to find. Antiviral and antibody options depend on your health risk and if you take other medications. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. The National Institutes of Health last week advised doctors to try an antiviral pill first for their high-risk COVID-19 patients, but whether that's the right treatment option depends on your health and what you can find quickly. In Colorado, high-risk people who contract the virus have access to two drugs given intravenously and two different pills to try to prevent severe illness. All but one can be used in people 12 and older, as long as they have a positive COVID-19 test and have mild or moderate symptoms. The NIH guidelines advise that doctors first consider Paxlovid, an antiviral pill made by Pfizer, for their patients who aren't severely ill but are in a high risk of getting to that point. If that isn't an option, the agency recommended monoclonal antibodies, the antiviral drug remdesivir, and finally Merck's pill molnupiravir, which showed lower effectiveness in clinical trials. In practice, patients may not have a menu of drugs to choose from. Colorado has only received a few hundred doses of monoclonal antibodies each week this year, and the pills are still difficult to find, even as manufacturing ramps up. The shortages pose a particular problem because patients have a limited window for treatment. The best option for you depends on how high your risk is, whether you take other medications, and what's available in your area, said Dr. Michael Roshan, Vice President of Physician Residencies and Research Operations at Penrose St. Francis Health Services. "It's driven by your individual risk," he said. Below is a guide to the treatment options for high-risk patients. Paxlovid. Paxlovid targets an enzyme the virus needs to reproduce. If taken within 5 days after symptoms start, it reduces the odds of hospitalization or death by about 88%. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized it for COVID-19 patients 12 and older who have a compromised immune system or another condition that puts them at risk for severe disease, such as age 65 or older, obesity or overweight, pregnancy, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, heart disease or high blood pressure, chronic lung disease, including moderate or severe asthma, sickle cell disease, neurodevelopmental disorders such as cerebral palsy or complex genetic conditions, reliance on medical technology such as a breathing tube or feeding tube. Paxlovid has a long list of interactions with other drugs, including those for seizures and certain heart problems, so a doctor needs carefully to go over the medications and supplements you use before prescribing it. It also isn't recommended for people with severe liver or kidney disease. Monoclonal antibodies. These are lab-created versions of substances that the body creates to fight the virus that causes COVID-19. Given early, they can reduce the odds that a high-risk person will be hospitalized or die by up to 85%. They aren't particularly convenient, though, because they have to be given intravenously within the first 10 days after symptoms start. Until recently, the state allowed people to attest that they qualify as high risk. That's no longer the case, Roshan said, because two of the three available antibody products don't work well against the Omicron variant. And Colorado gets only a few hundred doses of the remaining option, Sotruvimab. Other states also don't get nearly enough to treat everyone who could benefit. Now the state health department recommends providers write prescriptions only for people who have compromised immune systems or two other risk factors, Roshan said. Given the limited supply, it makes sense to reserve the drugs for the people at the highest risk, particularly because lower-risk people tend to do relatively well with the Omicron infection, he said. Because the supply of the antiviral pills isn't as tight, patients seeking those only need one risk factor. When we were dealing with the Alpha variant, or Delta, we had multiple monoclonal antibodies that would help, he said. We simply don't have enough to go around, so we have to be judicious. Remdesivir. This is perhaps the least convenient option because COVID-19 patients have to get the antiviral drug intravenously on 3 consecutive days, with the first treatment within 7 days after symptoms start. The FDA authorized remdesivir for people hospitalized with COVID-19, but doctors can choose to prescribe it off-label. Studies have found it reduces the risk of hospitalization or death by about 87%. Molnupiravir. Molnupiravir induces mutations in the virus until it becomes non-functional. It's not recommended for patients who are pregnant, and the NIH advises men who have a partner who could become pregnant to use reliable contraception for 3 months afterward. Breastfeeding patients should discard any milk pumped while receiving the drug and for 4 days afterward. Unlike the other medications, this one is only recommended for people 18 and older because of concerns about bone and cartilage growth. It also has a lower effectiveness than the other options, reducing the risk of hospitalization or death by about 30% if taken within the first 5 days of symptoms. Some scientists are also worried that people taking the drug accidentally could spread versions of the virus with mutations, giving new variants a chance to take off. Options for hospitalized patients. Monoclonal antibodies and the two antiviral pills aren't effective once patients are sick enough to be hospitalized. Remdesivir may be helpful for people who need low levels of supplemental oxygen, although its effectiveness still drops after a person has been sick for 10 days, according to the NIH guidelines for hospitalized COVID patients. If a patient needs a high level of supplemental oxygen or is placed on a ventilator, the main option is dexamethasone or a similar steroid. Some patients also get other drugs to suppress the immune system, but it's not clear how much of an advantage that offers over steroids alone. After the first 5 to 10 days, most patients have cleared the virus out of their system, but some develop a dangerous immune reaction that puts them in the hospital, Rashan said. Some patients take longer to clear the virus, especially if they have compromised immune systems. At that point, fighting inflammation is a priority, he said. All the antivirals in the world won't help you after that, he said. Omicron wave leaves U.S. food bank scrambling for volunteers, by Ashraf Khalil, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Food banks across the country are experiencing a critical shortage of volunteers as the Omicron variant frightens people away from their usual shifts, and companies and schools that regularly supply large groups of volunteers are canceling their participation over virus fears. The end result in many cases has been a serious increase in spending by the food banks at a time when they are dealing with higher food costs because of inflation and supply chain issues. Food banks rely on volunteers. That's how we keep the costs low, said Shirley Schofield, CEO of the Food Bank of North America. The work still gets done, but at a much higher expense. The extent of the problem was highlighted last week during Martin Luther King Jr. Day, when many food banks traditionally organize mass volunteer drives as part of a day of service. Michael Altfest, Director of Community Engagement for the Alameda County Community Food Bank in Oakland, California, called it, without fail, our biggest volunteer event of the year. But many food banks chose to cancel their plans this year or continued with radically lower numbers than pre-pandemic years. Altfest said his food bank's King Day event drew 73 people, spread out over 2 shifts, when previous years had drawn more than 200 people with all volunteer slots booked up before New Year's Day. The food bank did not attempt an event last year. In Tallahassee, Florida, plans for a volunteer-driven event on the holiday were canceled when all the volunteers dropped out. Schofield said executives at her food bank in Huntsville, Alabama, are debating whether to cut back on their mobile food pantry distributions because they do not have enough volunteer-packed food boxes to hand out. The shortage of volunteers is not universal. Michael Manning of the Greater Baton Rouge Food Bank in Louisiana said his volunteer numbers have remained strong, and his Martin Luther King Day event proceeded normally with 2 shifts of more than 50 people. But several food banks have reported a similar dynamic: minimal volunteers for most of 2021, then a surge last fall through November and December before falling off a cliff in January. Food banks generally use volunteers to sort through donations and to pack boxes of goods for distribution. It is common practice to arrange for local companies or schools to send large groups of volunteers, but that has left the system vulnerable to those institutions pulling out all at once. At the second harvest of the Big Bend Food Bank in Tallahassee, the volunteer members have remained solid through the Omicron surge, but CEO Monique Van Pelt said she was forced to cancel her MLK Day plans because the volunteers all came from a single corporate partner that didn't think it was safe for them to be gathering as a group in such tight quarters. Jamie Sizemore planned for 54 volunteers from 3 corporate groups at the Feeding America Food Bank in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. But 2 groups canceled, and the third sent less than half its promised number. We did manage to pick up some last-minute individuals for a total of 12 volunteers for the day, said Sizemore, the executive director. She added that a long-term contingent of 8 assigned Kentucky National Guardsmen frequently help fill the volunteer gap. Even outdoor volunteer work with seemingly less exposure risk than warehouse work has suffered. In Irvine, California, the Second Harvest Food Bank of Orange County has launched an ambitious farm project on 45 acres of land provided by University of California. So far, 22 acres have been planted with cabbage and broccoli, and it's harvest time. The plan was conceived with the intention of using up to 300 volunteers per week, organizing groups from corporate partners such as Disney. But most of the partnering organizations have suspended their volunteer drives amid the Omicron surge. It's a bummer because it's a great outdoor experience, said Claudia Keller, the food bank CEO. We're crossing our fingers that this is a short-term thing. We know many of the volunteers are champing at the bit to get out there. The sudden absence of volunteer labor forces most food banks into more expensive choices. When the farm runs short of volunteers, paid laborers are employed. At the Capital Area Food Bank in Washington, D.C., CEO Radha Muthia has to order truckloads of prepackaged boxes of mixed goods to distribute because there aren't enough volunteers to pack. When it's prepackaged, that tends to increase the price significantly, Muthia said. A truckload of produce on pallets costs about $9,000, but a truckload of ready-to-distribute care packages can cost $13,000 to $18,000, she said. In addition to the financial costs, some executives point out a more subtle impact. Volunteerism is about more than just getting the boxes packed, said Schofield from the Alabama Food Bank. It builds camaraderie and a sense of community. It's a sign of a healthy community at large. Vince Hall, Government Relations Officer for Feeding America, which coordinates the work of more than 200 food banks, said the volunteer numbers are partially a reflection of long-term emotional fatigue and burnout. As the nation endures a second pandemic winter and the Omicron variant rolls back some of the progress people expected from the vaccine, long-term volunteers are wearing down. These people, who are really part of the bedrock of our volunteer workforce, they've been doing this since March 2020, Hall said. It takes an emotional toll. In Denver and the West news briefs, Denver courts extend suspension of jury trials over Omicron concerns. A suspension of jury trials in Denver because of the COVID-19 Omicron variant has been extended through February 11th. In extending the suspension for health safety reasons related to Omicron, Chief Judge Michael A. Martinez noted Friday that Colorado's seven-day positivity rate was 26.39% and Denver's rate was 22.9%. At the start of the month, jury trials also were suspended in Jefferson, Broomfield, Adams, Arapahoe, Douglas, Elbert, and Lincoln counties until at least Friday, if not longer, because of Omicron. The highest seven-day positivity rate in the state on Friday was Lake County at 40.5%. The Denver order is subject to review and revision in accordance with prevailing public health trends, as well as guidelines from the CDPHE and DDPHE, Martinez wrote. Man hit by vehicle in Denver dies at hospital. A pedestrian who was hit by a vehicle in Denver on Friday night died at a hospital. The crash happened about 10:50 p.m. at South Federal Boulevard and West Jewell Avenue, according to police. The pedestrian, a man suffering serious injuries, was taken to a hospital, police said late Friday. On Saturday afternoon, police announced the man had died. The driver remained at the scene. An investigation is ongoing. Woman killed in Denver, suspect in custody. Denver police are investigating a homicide that left a woman dead, and a suspect is in custody. The stabbing, described as a domestic violence incident, happened at the Western Hills Motel, 5035 West Colfax Avenue, according to police. A suspect, Israel Cesaris, 49, is being held on investigation of first-degree murder. Police were called to the motel at 11:05 p.m. Friday. The victim's identity, as well as her cause and manner of death, will be released by the Denver Medical Examiner's Office. Two people shot in Green Valley Ranch area. Two people shot in the Green Valley Ranch area of Denver on Saturday afternoon were taken to a hospital. The double shooting happened in the 14,000 block of East 52nd Avenue, according to police. The injuries do not appear to be life-threatening, police said. An investigation is ongoing. These were from Kiernan Nicholson, the Denver Post. In other briefs, Wildfire in Big Sur forces residents to evacuate. More than 500 residents in the Big Sur area of California were told to evacuate Friday into Saturday as a brush fire spread through the mountainous coastal region. The fire was stubbornly active, according to the National Weather Service, as intense, gusty winds of up to 50 miles per hour blew the flames erratically along the area's steep canyons. By Saturday morning, the fire, known as the Colorado Fire, grew to 1,500 acres after starting a little after 5 p.m. Friday in the Palo Colorado Canyon area. Just one structure had burned by Saturday. The cause of the fire, which on Saturday afternoon was 5% contained, is under investigation. The blaze swept through an area with little or no fire history, according to the National Weather Service. Pictures on social media suggest some pretty surreal fire behavior, given the wet October and December that was observed across the region, the National Weather Service said on Twitter. Video shows struggle that preceded restrained teen's death. Byline, Wichita, Kansas. Surveillance video shows a black 17-year-old struggling with workers at a Wichita juvenile center in the fall before he died. He was restrained face down for more than 30 minutes. Sedgwick County released 18 video clips Friday of what happened before Cedric Lofton was rushed to a hospital September 24th. He died 2 days later. The release of the clips followed Sedgwick County District Attorney Mark Bennett's announcement Thursday that the state's Stand Your Ground law prevented him from pressing charges because staff members were protecting themselves. He also said he struggled with whether a charge of involuntary manslaughter was justified, but he concluded it was not. Virginia School District is adding security after parent charged with making threat over mask mandates. A Virginia woman was charged with a misdemeanor Friday after she issued a threat at a school board meeting if the district continued to enforce a mask mandate where her children attend class. Mask mandates were the topic of the evening at the Page County Public Schools board meeting in Luray, Virginia, Thursday night, when Amelia Ruffner King stepped to the podium to speak. "My children will not come to school on Monday with a mask on, all right?" King, 42, said, "That's not happening, and I will bring every single gun loaded and ready to, I will call every," she was cut off before she could finish. "I'll see you all on Monday," King said as she left. The remarks caused school officials to plan for an increased police presence throughout the district Monday. Virginia has been the site of acrimonious debates over pandemic mandates at public schools. Stray bullet kills English astrophysicist visiting Atlanta. Byline, Brookhaven, Georgia. A stray bullet struck and killed an English astrophysicist while he was inside an Atlanta-area apartment, authorities say. Matthew Wilson, 31, of Chertsey, Surrey, England, was visiting his girlfriend in the United States when he was hit by a bullet that pierced the wall of the apartment. The shooting happened early Sunday morning, only 3 days into his visit. "He was supposed to be here for 3 months because we'd been long distance for a while," Catherine Shepard, his girlfriend of 3 years, told WSB-TV. "I picked him up from the airport, took him to his favorite eating location, and the next day, he's gone." Shepard told the television station that the couple woke up January 16th to the sound of more than 30 gunshots coming from an apartment complex directly behind Shepard's. "A bullet traveled through Shepard's wall, hitting Wilson," she said. These briefs were from Denver Post Wire Services. Arizona Democrats censure cinema over voting rights bill. By Jonathan J. Cooper, The Associated Press. Byline, Phoenix. U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema is growing increasingly isolated from some of her party's most influential officials and donors after playing a key role in scuttling voting rights legislation that many Democrats consider essential to preserving democracy. Leaders of the Arizona Democratic Party voted Saturday to censure Sinema, a symbolic condemnation for the woman who just 3 years ago brought the party an Arizona Senate seat for the first time in a generation. Donors are threatening to walk away. Several groups are collecting money for an eventual primary challenge, even though she's not on the ballot until 2024. Young activists are holding a second hunger strike to draw attention to Sinema's vote. The moves offer a preview of the persistent opposition Sinema likely will face within her own party in the 2 years before she next appears on a ballot. The independent streak that has given her tremendous leverage over the agenda in Washington has enraged many Democrats back home who are intent on preventing her reelection. Any reservoir of goodwill that she has had is gone, said Representative Ruben Gallego, an Arizona Democrat who may challenge Sinema from the left. Sinema's defenders say nobody who has watched her for the past decade should be surprised by her position. She often bucked her party in the House, ran an aggressively moderate campaign for Senate, and has never wavered in her support for upholding the filibuster. During three terms in the U.S. House and now in the Senate, Kirsten has always promised Arizonans she would be an independent voice for the state, not for either political party. Hannah Hurley, Sinema's spokesperson, said in a statement before the censure vote. She's delivered for Arizonans and has always been honest about where she stands. Hurley repeated her comments in response to the censure. Sinema's influence is driven by the Senate's 50-50 split, which essentially gives any senator the ability to kill legislation, an option Sinema has exercised repeatedly. But she faces political dynamics unlike the other Senate moderate thwarting Democratic ambitions, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Representing a state that former President Donald Trump carried by nearly 39 percentage points in 2020, Manchin is unlikely to face a progressive challenger who would gain traction. In Arizona, however, Democrats are ascendant. Joe Biden was the first Democratic presidential candidate to carry the state since 1996, and the party is eager to build on that success. That makes it harder for a Democrat simply to ignore the left here, particularly in a primary election. Sinema supports the Democrats' voting rights legislation, but steadfastly opposes passing it by changing or eliminating the Senate's filibuster rule, which effectively requires 60 of 100 votes to pass most legislation. On Wednesday night, she joined Manchin and all the Republicans to oppose a one-time rule change so the bill could pass with a simple majority. LaFonza Butler, president of Emily's List, an important fundraising group for Democratic women who support abortion rights, said in a statement that Sinema's vote means she will find herself standing alone in the next election. She said the group would not endorse her reelection if she doesn't support a path forward for voting rights legislation. Primary Sinema Project, which is raising money for an eventual primary challenge, said it has collected more than $300,000 from nearly 12,000 donors. We are quite literally doing everything we physically possibly can in terms of putting our bodies on the line and trying to plead for this action because the consequences of inaction are far worse than starving or going to jail or both, said Shana Gallagher, one of about three dozen young people holding a hunger strike to protest Sinema and Manchin. Gallagher is co-founder of UNPAC, launched last year to organize young people in favor of passing voting rights legislation. Senator Bernie Sanders, a Vermont independent whose fundraising and mobilization abilities are virtually unmatched on the left, suggested he would support primary challengers to Sinema and Manchin. Sinema says the filibuster forces bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. With Roe in doubt, states act on abortion limits expansions, by Lindsay Whitehurst, the Associated Press, byline Salt Lake City. It didn't take long for abortion to reemerge as a flashpoint in state legislatures. Less than a month into the 2022 legislative sessions, battles over the future of abortion are setting up around the U.S. Republican lawmakers are proposing new restrictions modeled after laws in Texas and Mississippi that present a direct challenge to the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, while some Democratic-led states are working to preserve or expand access. The activity in state legislatures was anticipated after the U.S. Supreme Court, with its conservative majority, signaled it was ready to make seismic changes to the nationwide right to abortion that has stood for nearly half a century. If the court overturns Roe v. Wade entirely, the decision on whether to keep abortion legal would fall to the states. More than 20 states already have laws on the books to ban or dramatically restrict abortion if Roe v. Wade is overturned. As legislative sessions begin, several are considering new laws. This could be a really, really dramatic year in terms of people's ability to access abortion care and to decide if, when, and how they become a parent, said Kristen Ford, Vice President of Communications and Outreach at NARAL Pro-Choice America, an abortion rights group. At this time next year, we could be looking at a scenario in which more than half of the country has lost access to abortion. It will have consequences for everyone. Against that backdrop, California lawmakers will consider plans this year to become a sanctuary for those seeking reproductive care. That could include paying for travel, lodging, and procedures for people coming from other states. We are confronting an all-out assault on reproductive freedom in America. There are powerful forces working tirelessly to drag us backward. But here in California, we're not going back, said Assemblywoman Cottie Petrie Norris. As state lawmakers propose 8 bills Thursday, we will continue to fight for reproductive freedom. Susan Arnall, Director of Outreach for the Anti-Abortion Right to Life League, said other Democratic-led states are likely to follow California's lead. Her organization is fighting the legislation introduced in the nation's most populous state. Even so, she said abortion opponents have gained the upper hand throughout the U.S. Life is winning, and the abortion industry is losing, Arnall said. Other Democratic-leaning states are not yet following California, although New Jersey recently became the 15th state to protect the right to abortion in state law, according to the Guttmacher Institute, an abortion rights think tank. Colorado Democratic lawmakers plan to bring a bill that would ensure abortions remain legal in the state, even if Roe v. Wade is overturned. Although some Republicans are urging a wait-and-see approach based on what the U.S. Supreme Court does, Democrats are forging ahead. Vermont could move toward enshrining reproductive autonomy in its constitution this year. In Michigan, abortion rights groups are seeking an amendment enshrining the right to an abortion in the state constitution. Meanwhile, at least 7 states could follow Texas, which effectively has banned abortions after 6 weeks with a law strategically written to avoid a federal court challenge. The Supreme Court has allowed the law to remain in effect, even though it appears to contradict the Roe decision. Similar proposals have been introduced in Ohio, Alabama, Oklahoma, Missouri, Florida, and Arizona. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, a possible 2024 presidential contender, released a proposal Friday modeled after the Texas law. She said it would ensure that both unborn children and their mothers are protected in South Dakota. Other states that already have 6-week bans on the books could also amend those measures to look more like the Texas law so they can take effect, said Katie Glenn, Government Affairs Counsel at Americans United for Life, an anti-abortion group. The Texas law is unusual because it allows private citizens to file lawsuits against anyone who helps someone else get an abortion after 6 weeks. It has made legal challenges difficult because the government is not involved in enforcement. More than a dozen states have passed abortion bans after 6 weeks, but have seen those efforts blocked by the courts. That has made the Texas model more attractive to conservative lawmakers. Our message to lawmakers is full steam ahead. If you have felt like maybe something's not worth doing because it might be enjoined or you're worried about it, this is a great opportunity for state lawmakers to let the Supreme Court know. We've got this, Glenn said. How bad is Colorado crime? Politicians call it a wave, but 35 years of data puts today's trends in context, by Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Not all types of crime are rising. Although Colorado's rates for homicide, aggravated assault, and motor vehicle theft rose more than 10% in 2020 over the average of the prior 3 years, rates for rape, larceny, robbery, and burglary stayed relatively level or declined. Violent crime. Colorado's 2020 rate of violent crime was the highest that it's been since 1995, but it is lower than it was from 1985 to 1995. The state's 2020 property crime rate was the highest recorded since 2008, but is less than half the rate recorded in the mid-1980s. Is Colorado less safe than it used to be? The answer is not as simple as the question seems. It depends on where you live, who you ask, and against which decade you're comparing today's crime. Colorado, as many other states have, has experienced shocking spikes in violence during the pandemic. The state's homicide rate in 2020 surged to a 25-year high after 293 people were killed, leaving more than 5 people dead every week on average. Motor vehicle thefts and aggravated assaults, such as shootings and stabbings, skyrocketed statewide as well. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.